Now, we heard four sermons on the subject of problems that arise in the church and how those problems should be handled and the responsibility that is placed upon the lay members in these problems. What we want to emphasize to you is for you brethren to shoulder this responsibility and to be able to help us out in the ministry in being able to maintain peace and quiet and calmness and everything that should exist in the church. But the big problem, of course, that we discussed when we were going over all this material earlier was that if this is not handled properly, if it's not implemented in a wise and a judicious manner, it'll cause far more problems than it will solve. So what it really means is not only is it a matter of the church membership realizing its responsibility and what should be done, it is also a matter of knowing how to handle it. And this is what I want to dwell on today, how we should handle these various problems should they arise. Now, you will remember a number of examples of categories where a problem could be noted and observed and engaged in one manner or another by church members. One of those, of course, was division. Anyone who generates division. And it's interesting, if you go to Romans, the 16th chapter, in verse number 17, when it's talking here about this particular text here, it says, I beseech you, brethren, mark them, or take notice of, or note them, which, and it's rather interesting, the Greek is, which are causing divisions. It is not a matter of just a single act, it's a matter of a progressive program that an individual is on. Those which are causing divisions and offenses contrary to the doctrine which you have learned, and avoid them. That was one of the points covered. And then we had the matter of contrary doctrine in 1 Timothy 6. I'm just touching on these to set the stage here for what I want to say following. 1 Timothy 6, verse number 3. If any man, and here we go. See, we're talking about again about a progressive thing that's going on. If any man is teaching otherwise and consenting not. So what you see is a consistent pattern of behavior here. He does not consent to the wholesome words, even the words of our Lord Jesus Christ, and the doctrine which is according to godliness. And then we can skip down here to the bottom part of verse number 5. From such withdraw thyself. So that was another one of those categories. Then we have the matter of the man in 1 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, and then Paul elaborated on it somewhat more so in verse number 11. So here was another category. I have written unto you not to associate or keep company or associate with any man that is called a brother if he be a fornicator or covetous. Now, how are you going to tell someone who's covetous? You know, don't we all have covetousness in one manner or another? So what this is really saying here, here's a man that's got a covetous problem that is so bad, it just becomes obvious for everyone to see it. Maybe he is desiring other people's goods, or he is doing things in such a manner that it calls attention to what he does, and it becomes very obnoxious to the membership. Maybe always trying to take advantage of people one way or another, monetarily or whatever. And don't think that hasn't happened. And an idolater, however that should be applied, I'm sure it wouldn't be talking about someone who is bowing down and worshiping idols, although back in that day it could include that, but it certainly includes any other categories of idolatry. The Bible says covetousness, which is idolatry. So we're looking here at really major problems. And a railer, someone who just loses his temper and just flies off the handle and shouts and bellows and screams and puts other people down, this is a railer. And then, as it says here, a drunkard, someone that can't handle their alcohol. Now, maybe they don't get drunk publicly, and maybe they don't get drunk when they get on the road, but do they get drunk at home every weekend? And are they soused at home? So we're talking about drunkards here. And then an extortioner. Somebody here who is, the Greek literally means ravening, someone who's just ravening. He's just trying to take advantage of everyone. It makes you think of what the Bible says back in the book of Proverbs when it says, a wicked man, I'm paraphrasing it because I don't remember the exact phraseology, but it's words to the effect that a wicked man does not pay back his loans. He's very willing to borrow money, but then he will not pay back. Maybe that's a form of extortion. I don't really know, but this means somebody who's ravenous here. With such a one, know not to eat. So here's another category. And I'm not covering all the various ones covered. I'm just hitting the four general categories here. But here's one more in Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse number 14. Here he gives this instruction here about freeloaders who are taking advantage of the other church members, not working, busybodies. And then notice what he says in verse 14 here, if any man obey not our word by this epistle, note that man and have no company with him, that he may be ashamed. So what it really shows here very plainly is a matter of peace and harmony in the church rests to a good extent upon the lay members. It isn't the ministry's job to go out and police everyone, be sure everyone is living up to this and living up to that, and pry in all their private affairs and things of that nature. That's not the job of the ministry. So if it comes to a matter here where it is generating, creating a problem, you do have a responsibility laid upon you. But now, that leads to the question here, how do we handle it? What is the proper and the Christian way to handle this? Well, I'm going to give four major points today. And I think if we can really grasp and understand what these four major points are, we will be able to see there is a proper way. If God expects you to handle this, I can tell you this. He also expects you to handle it in a Christian manner. Not in a carnal manner. And if it's handled in a carnal manner, it will be disastrous. So this is why we need to really understand thoroughly how we should handle it as Christian members if should these problems arise. First of all, first and foremost, first cast the beam out of your own eye. How can you go around, or how can we go around correcting others when we have major problems of our own? Isn't that what Jesus said? Go back and notice the Sermon on the Mount here. This is absolutely the center, the heart and core of all Christianity, is this Sermon on the Mount, and it's probably the one that is applied the least. But we read here in Matthew chapter 7, judge not, this is verse 1, judge not that you be not judged. And in this particular case, the Greek word means condemn, pass sentence on. I mean, you've already decided the person isn't fit to live and they should go to the lake of fire, and you've decided that they deserve that. You're not to do that. Or let's say we are not to do that. Do not condemn that you be not condemned. For with what judgment you judge, you shall be judged. That's why the Bible tells us the only one who really is in a category to pass sentence is God in Christ. We don't have that. We've never been given that authority in that office. That only belongs to God. And with what measure you meet. You know, this is a thing that I'm just struck by it every time I see some media person get criticized. Have you ever watched a media person get criticized? How do they take it? I mean, they are the worst sports you ever stayed. They cannot take any criticism. They can't handle it all. You criticize them the least and they just go bonkers practically. But they can sure dish it out, can't they? Oh, they can just pour it on someone something awful, but criticize them and see what happens. That's why he says here, with what measure you meet, it shall be measured again to you. You are going to receive it in like manner, sooner or later. And why do you behold a mote that is in your brother's eye? He's got this little sliver in his eye, and you consider not the beam, the huge beam that is in your own eye. Or how will you say to your brother, let me pull out the mote out of your eye, and behold, a beam is in your own eye? You hypocrite. You know, the most amazing thing about human nature is that it's almost impossible for people to really see themselves as others see them. We have a certain notion and idea of what we're like, but that may not be the way other people see us at all. That's why it says, you hypocrite. See, whoever's doing this has this idea, this image in his mind that he's in this category, and he's perfectly legitimate in saying or doing what he's going to be doing to somebody else, and he's got his own problems that are probably worse in another way. Now, that doesn't mean, however, that nothing should be said to an offending party, but it means if you want to assume that responsibility, you better be certain that you're clear and above board yourself. You hypocrite, first cast out the beam out of your own eye, and then, see if you can do that, you get yourself straightened up first, then you'll be able to see clearly to cast the mote out of your brother's eye. But don't try to cast it out of your brother's eye if you still have it in your own eye. So that's one of the first principles here we need to realize. Now, there are different kinds of people we have to deal with all the time. And we have to learn to evaluate people and their problems. And we have to know how to handle those problems accordingly. So as we read here in Romans, the 15th chapter, verse number 1, we then that are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak. So what we're going to find on occasion is we're going to find somebody that has an infirmity. Now, what does this Greek word mean here when it talks about infirmity? The Greek word literally means an error from the weakness of mind. In other words, somebody has a certain mental deficiency. They're not able to grasp or comprehend things the way they matter, the way they should, and so they make an error. They make some kind of an error. It may not deliberate at all. All right, we then that are strong, we're the strong ones spiritually, then we had ought to bear the infirmities of the weak and not to please ourselves. Let every one of us please his neighbor for his good to edification. So the primary aim and goal should be to help other people, not to try to hinder and harm them. Now the question is, how do you help somebody? I'm well aware there are people that you can't help. No matter what you may try to do, you're not going to be able to help them. That's another matter altogether. But to a large extent, whether or not a person is capable of being helped or not is going to depend on how that person is approached. You know, my brother was in the 2 percentile of management of Phillips 66. He was in charge of energy exploration worldwide for Phillips 66. And I asked him one time, I said, Dean, how did you handle these problems with people when you had this responsibility? He said it was very simple. He said, I always dealt and talked with them in the way that I would like to be talked to if I were in their place. I'll tell you, that's an important key. So when you go over here to Romans, the 15th chapter, or rather back to Romans, the 14th chapter, we read, him that is weak in the faith, receive ye. Now, if he's weak in the faith, it means he doesn't understand all things properly. He may be doing things improperly. How would you like to be talked to if you were in that particular position? How would you like to be addressed? That's a primary question we need to ask ourselves. For one believes that he may eat all things, and another who is weak eateth herbs. So in this particular case, he's a vegetarian. Now, let's go down to verse number 10 here. Why do you judge your brother? Or why do you set it not your brother? For we'll all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. And this, from reading the context, appears to be non-salvational issues, personal preferences of one type or another that people come up with. And rather than sitting in judgment because he doesn't agree with you, you know, there are people who are excessively controlling. And the reason that they're so controlling is that they want everyone to think and to react just the way they do. And that's an impossibility. People are individuals, and they will react differently, and they will think differently, and that can't be helped. That's just the way it is. So that's why he says here, we're all going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ. For it is written, as I live, saith the Lord, every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue shall confess to God. So then every one of us shall give account of himself to God. Let us not therefore judge one another. Fault finding. Looking around for this and looking around for that. Because people don't match up to what we think our standards should be. There are different levels of faith for different people at different periods of time. But judge this rather. Here's the thing you should really judge. That no man put a stumbling block or an occasion to fall in his brother's way. Well, I can tell you, if we're busy judging and condemning and finding fault and criticizing, that's exactly what is being done. A stumbling block is being thrown in someone's way. That doesn't mean you have to condone sin and things that are wrong. But we're dealing here with people who are of the weaker type. So what you have to realize here is the very first principle we need to understand in this whole subject is we first have to be sure that the beam is out of our own eye and we're in a position to really genuinely help someone. That's point number one. Now, point number two. Do unto others as you would like done to you. You'll be amazed how many times when people get into problems and troubles, children often do, and then they get disciplined. And while at the time they won't say it, later on they will admit to their friends or their peers that they deserved it. They had it coming. Isn't that true? Of course it is. Well, if that's true, then what we have to realize is that if someone is correcting us and we would like them to do to us as we would do to them, one of the primary things is to own up to where we made a mistake. One of the things that made David so outstanding was that when he was corrected by Nathan the prophet for his sin with Bathsheba and her husband Uriah, his very immediate reply was, "I have sinned before God," or "I have sinned." He admitted it. That's very difficult for many people to do. But notice the instruction here that Jesus gave in Matthew the 7th chapter. Once again, here we go back to the Sermon on the Mount. And in Matthew the 7th chapter, as we read here, verse number 12, Matthew 7 verse 12, "Therefore all things whatsoever you would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them. For this is the law and the prophets." So that's the next important key one should understand in this matter of handling these problems. I would think that one of the primary things, if I were going to address someone and they really had done something wrong, I think after finding out whether they're willing to admit they've done something wrong, I think the logical next thing to do would be to ask them why. But if we go in there with the idea in mind that they're going to be pummeled into the ground and they're going to kowtow, it's going to do more harm than good. It may come to that eventually, because when it gets to that point, the ministry will have to handle it. But as far as a lay member's handling, that it should never have to come to that from a lay member. Luke 6, verse number 31. "And as you would that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise." So that's the next important point that needs to be emphasized with respect to this matter of handling a problem. Notice Philippians 2, verse number 3. "Let nothing be done through strife." Now what if you're upset with someone and you go to them to correct them and you're mad as a hornet and then you enter into the whole thing with strife? What's it going to lead to? It isn't going to solve anything. It's only going to make it worse. That's why he says, "Let nothing." Does that mean everything, or does that just mean certain things? "Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory." which is simply a matter of the person doing the correcting has a sort of an exalted opinion of themselves and they feel above the other party. But in lowness of mind, let each esteem other better than themselves. You know, it's the easiest thing in the world to agree to the doctrine. That is, once you prove it. But how hard is it to really live up to it? When we get riled up over some issue and the old carnal nature begins to come out, how easy is it to really apply Christianity then? You know, we talk about overcoming. I can tell you, you never know whether you're making progress until you see what your reaction is at the worst, at your worst moment. Not when things are going smoothly and easy, it's when you're at your worst moment. How do you respond? So let nothing be done through strife or vainglory. Galatians 5, verse number 15. Paul was well aware of the proclivity for human beings to become incensed and angry and begin to fight with one another. So here's what he said. Keep this in mind now. A particular problem arises and you feel that you have your obligation, your duty to do something about it. Here's what it says. Galatians 5, verse 15. If you bite and devour one another, take heed that you be not consumed one of another. That's what it's going to lead to, a dog fight. And, the people will be torn apart by it. So that's why it says here that we must be very careful. Verse 14, all the law is fulfilled in this one word, even in this, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. So you see, that leads right back to the basic question. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 15. See that none render evil for evil unto any man. But ever follow that which is good both among yourselves and to all men. So, if one goes to confront an issue or a problem that we've discussed in these sermons, and he's angry, he's revengeful, he has a bitterness in him, is that going to lead to righteousness or is that going to lead to evil? This is what we need to understand about this. Now that leads to the third point. We must restore in a spirit of meekness. In a spirit of meekness. Now let's go to Galatians and we'll notice what the text says here. Galatians 6, verse number 1. Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault. So really what it means here, he's gotten to the point where it's gotten control of him. He has lost the ability to maintain order in his own life and in his own department. So he has been overtaken it. All right. You which are spiritual. You know, a good question we should ask ourselves if we're going to confront someone like that. Are we spiritual? Or do we have problems that are just as bad in other ways? You see, the problem is, if one goes to correct another party or goes to confront another party or whatever the particular circumstance might be here, if you have faults that are recognized and known, do you think you're going to be listened to? Do you think people are going to heed what you say when they know you've got problems yourself that are in other ways that are just as bad in the sight of God? Why, your words are going to fall on empty ears. That's why it's very important as we read, are you which are spiritual? All right. Restore such a one in a spirit of meekness. What does it say? Tear him to shreds? See how much damage and harm you can do? Humiliate him? Rail against him? Is that what you're supposed to do? No, it says restore. You don't restore someone like that. It's just like your children. If you have a child and all you do all your life is just criticize that child and just tear him apart, that child will grow up as a loser. you give your children encouragement and you build them up, not to the place where a particular family I knew, because the mother was just always bragging on her children and always just telling them how great they are, and they actually thought they were when they weren't. So there's a good balance. There has to be a balance in it. I remember one time we were playing in a tournament, a basketball tournament, and I wouldn't want this tape to get back to anybody who would even hear this incident. He's a good friend of mine too. This one particular friend of mine, he came down the court. His mother had told him how great he was all his life. He got about to the center of the line and he decided to shoot. And he ended up hitting the rafters in the ceiling. And everybody in the whole auditorium, there were 4,000 or 5,000 people in that auditorium, started laughing. It was embarrassing. So, you know, we have to handle these things wisely and appropriately, but if you know, it can be one extreme or the other. It has to be a balance of both to raise a child properly. You which are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness. Now, what do we mean by the word meekness here? I got awful mad at my computer program this morning because it has a feature to it, and it's a marvelous feature. All I do is just have to hit a couple of buttons, and not only will it give me the Greek meaning, it'll give me what tense and voice and mood it's in. But I got this update on this thing, and now it won't do that anymore. And I was fit to be tied this morning. I had to look things up the hard way instead of just pushing. I mean, it's a sad state of affairs when you get into, you don't even want to open a book anymore. All you want to do is push a button. Anyway, I had to look this up anyway. I found it the hard way. But anyway, meekness means gentleness. Gentleness. Restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Consideration. Courtesy and mildness. Mildness. The last thing in the world should ever be done is to do it in a vitriolic and emotional manner. That's going to do far more harm than good. I think if a person were talked to by that manner and saw that kind of conduct in the person who is doing the correcting, they would be impressed that this person really has love and has an attitude of helpfulness. That would go a long way in solving the problem. Hebrews 5, verse number 2. Here we have the type back in the Old Testament. And in the type we had in the Old Testament, we had every high priest taken from among men as ordained of God. This is Hebrews 5, verse number 1. He's ordained for men in things pertaining to God, that he may offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. And now here's what I want to emphasize, the next verse. Who can have compassion on the ignorant? Or your marginal rendering says, who can reasonably bear with the ignorant and on them that are out of the way, for that he himself also is compassed with infirmity? He knows his own faults and sins. I can remember it very well. I would be involved in a marital problem between a couple. Sometimes we'd have to talk for 2 or 3 hours to get things all squared away. And you know what that was? It was the biggest learning experience I ever had, every single time. Boy, I could see where I was doing this wrong, and I was doing that wrong, and I was out of line here, and I was out of line there. That's what it taught me. So that's why it says here, he also is compassed with infirmity. Well, is it any different today, even for the ministry as well as the lay members? We're all compassed with infirmities, aren't we? Meaning we all have human nature and faults and problems. Matthew 5, verse number 7. Again, that Sermon on the Mount. And here we read in verse number 7, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. So, being merciful is really a godly characteristic, it says here. Colossians 3, verse number 12. Put on, therefore, as the elect of God, and if we are God's elect, and we're the ones that have the knowledge of the truth that God has granted us, we're God's elect, holy and beloved, put on feelings of mercies. You know, one of the worst things that human beings can get into And this is particularly true in war. When men get involved in these terrible firefights and this type of thing, I mean, there is no mercy. There is no mercy. And if we're going to be the children of God and we're going to be involved in any of these type of things, mercy is paramount. That doesn't mean excuse and forgive, because it must be. We've got to be firm. If a person is really generating a problem, then we must be firm. But we must also be merciful. We must put on feelings of mercies. Kindness. You know, here gets back to that basic question. How would we like to be treated under those circumstances? Humbleness, which means lowliness of mind, where we don't have a great exalted opinion of ourselves because we realize our own weaknesses. And mildness, it has the word here, meekness, mildness. And long-suffering, having a lot of patience, forbearing one another and forgiving one another. And if any man have a quarrel against any, even as Christ forgave you, so also do you. One of the things you can absolutely be guaranteed on, and that applies to any single one of us, we will not receive any forgiveness from God if we cannot forgive other people. It will never happen. And Ephesians 4, verse number 32. Be ye kind one to another, tender-hearted. Tender-hearted. Forgiving one another, even as Christ for God's sake has forgiven you. Now keep that in mind if you receive a very positive response from whatever party you happen to be dealing with on the subject. Now I would say this, one of the primary things that we all need to pray for is wisdom. It's like the old saying, you probably heard this before. God, please give me the wisdom to change the things I can, to accept the things I can't, and above all, to know the difference between the two of them. So you see, we have to have a lot of wisdom. We need to be praying for wisdom so God will help us. You know, I would think if I were in a position where I had to go to someone over a problem like that, I would want to do a lot of thinking and praying about it first, probably even fasting, before I ventured in to do something that might be far more damage and do a lot more harm than good. But nevertheless, it needs, must be done. And if it needs to be done, then that's a responsibility God gives you. And that's what you're expected to do from here on out. Now, here's the fourth point. Love is the key to the whole approach. Love is the key. Now, we seem to think, at least a lot of people seem to think, that the principle of love was not really expanded to a spiritual level until the time of Christ. But you can see all kinds of examples in the Old Testament, even in God's law, where God was emphasizing the importance of applying love. Notice, for example, Exodus 23, verse number 5. Here's a case in point. Let's pick it up in verse 4. If you meet your enemy's ox or his ass going astray, you shall surely bring it back to him again. Here's your enemy. Somebody you dislike. Maybe someone that's done you harm. And if you see the ass of him that hateth you, so here's somebody that really has it in for you, and you know it, lying under his burden, and wouldst forbear to help him, thou shalt surely help with him. Here's a principle clear back in the Old Testament. Here's another one in Leviticus 19. Leviticus 19, verse number 18. You shall not avenge, nor bear any grudge against the children of your people. Do you carry a grudge? Oh, I used to be terrible for that. I was walking across the street in Washington, D.C. one time, and some punks punks came by in a fancy car and two or three of us tried to hit us. And they missed, of course, and then they pulled over and they jumped out of the car and they wanted to start a fight. I was ready to go. I'd already picked a big guy. I was looking at the little guy, but my first punch was going to be on the big guy. And just about that time, a policeman came up. So it broke up. You know what I did? Every place I went for the next 6 or 8 months, I looked for that guy. If I'd have seen him in a theater, I'd have drug him right out, right on the spot, and beat the tar out of him. That's the kind of an attitude I had for years. And I can tell you one thing, I wasn't afraid of a fight if you got me mad. I mean, that's terrible. Well, you see, those are the kind of things that we cannot allow to be a part of our life if we're going to practice Christianity. That's the way of the world. You know, the prisons are full of guys like that. They're in jail for a felony assault. Assault with intent to kill. Because they have never learned to control themselves. And if we're going to practice Christianity, those are things that we must never do. So as it says here, you shall not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of your people. What if somebody does say things? What if they've done you wrong? Well, that principle still applies. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now we all know, I'm sure we're familiar with the fact that the oldest single book in the Bible is the book of Job. And in the book of Job, chapter 31, Job is talking here about things that he did or didn't do. And he says here, I believe it's Job, yes, Job talking here. He has a long but he mentions specifically here in verse number 29 of verse number 30 of chapter 31, verse 29, if I rejoiced at the destruction of him that hateth me, or lifted up myself when evil found him. What he means by that is, he was not guilty of those things. Rejoicing at the destruction of him that hated me. So, we get it in for somebody and something happens to him and we say, well, he got what he deserved. He got what he asked for. He deserved it. That's not what God says to do. You see, or I lifted up myself. I was elated when evil caught up with him or found him. That's nothing to rejoice over. And that certainly is not a Christian principle. And in Proverbs 24, verse number 17, rejoice not when your enemy falls. It isn't anything to rejoice over. Now back to the Sermon on the Mount. Notice once again Matthew, the 5th chapter, and verse number 43. You have heard that it hath been said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Actually, the Bible doesn't say you should hate your enemy. In this particular case, the text here that it has reference to, referring to hating your enemy, is Deuteronomy 23, verse number 6. And in the context, when you read what happened there, that was right after the time that Israel went into idolatry at Baal Peor, and God is giving specific instruction against the Midianites and Moabites for what they did. But even then, he doesn't say hate them. But that's how they interpret it anyway. But I say to you, love your enemies. Boy, isn't that a task? Anybody here able to do that? I can tell you, if we have gotten to the place where we can virtually love our enemies, I tell you, we are making progress in overcoming. That is the gigantic task. Bless them that curse you. Now, Jesus is not saying here that this is just something you put on and you play act. If it doesn't come from the heart, it's meaningless. And do good to them that hate you. That's difficult to do, isn't it? Very difficult, if not impossible. But Jesus said, with God's help, all things are possible. So this is what he's talking about. Pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Now when we can come to that point, I can tell you we have really made progress. Romans chapter 13, verse number 9. For this, you shall not commit adultery. And it goes on a list of various commandments here, but I just want to emphasize the last one here, because this is certainly what we find as a principle, not only in the Old Testament, but in the New as well. And this is the latter part of this particular verse, which says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I remember Mr. Armstrong used to talk about that all the time, and he used to say, you know, if you love yourself, your neighbor just as much as you love yourself, you'll be giving him all kinds of love. Because almost always a natural, normal thing is to love the self more than anything else. Proverbs 10, verse number 12. Hatred stirs up strifes. So let me say this, that one of the primary problems that we experience as human beings is controlling this tongue. Very, very difficult. James said, the man that can control the tongue is a perfect man. What does hatred do? It stirs up strife, because what it does, it just lets itself go. Says things that are better off being left unsaid. But love covers all sins. In other words, it does not try to make a spectacle of people's shortcomings and mistakes. In Mark, the 12th chapter, in verse number 30, here we read the two primary commandments. The first of all is love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. And the second is namely this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And that's the Greek agape. That's not philios, which refers to a brotherhood, a brotherly type of love. This is a deep love that is expressed by God, agape. You shall agape your neighbor as yourself. Quite a test. So what I'm saying here is that the real principle in all of these problems and difficulties we face, the real key is love. Now let me read the description of love in 1 Corinthians, the 13th chapter, and I'm going to read this from the Moffat translation because it's so much better. 1 Corinthians 13, beginning here in verse number 4. You know, this is the thing we need to ask ourselves now as we're going through this. Are we growing in Christian love? Notice this. Love is very patient, very kind. Very kind. Love knows no jealousy. Love makes no parade. It gives itself no airs. And listen to this one. Is never rude. How many times are we rude? Is never rude. Never selfish. Never irritated. How many times do we get irritated? I was irritated this morning with that software. If I'd have come and been open, I'd have called him up today and given him a piece of my mind. That just shows you how human we all are, aren't we? Never irritated, never resentful. I think we all say we fall pretty short, don't we? You know what Jesus said? He said there's really one identifying sign. Sure, we can talk about the doctrine. That's axiomatic. But I can tell you this. He said the way people will know whether you're my disciples or not is whether you have love one for another. Whether you can apply these principles right here, or whether we all can. It is never resentful. Love is never glad when others go wrong. Love is gladdened by goodness. Always slow to expose. Always eager to believe the best. Always hopeful. Always patient. Love never disappears. You know, you talk about people falling in love. You hear songs about it all the time. Then all of a sudden you hear about them falling out of love. Well, if they fell in love, probably they were never in love in the first place. And if they really had love, they wouldn't be falling out of love, because it never disappears. That's a good description. I think we could all profit by when we think about this whole situation and handling this responsibility that is certainly scriptural in the Bible. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse number 8. Finally, be you all of one mind, having compassion one of another. Love as brethren. Be pitiful. Be courteous. Not rendering evil for evil, or railing for railing. We get into a shouting match with someone. Railing for railing. But contrawise blessing, knowing that you are thereunto called, that you should inherit a blessing. So that is the principle of love. And then as we read in 1 John 4, verse number 22, 1 John 4, verse 20, if a man say, I love God, and hateth his brother, he's a liar. For he that loveth not his brother whom he hath seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen? Now when we're talking about brothers, that's what we're talking about, brothers and sisters in the church, aren't we? And if it could be even expanded further, mankind in general. Galatians 5, verse number 22. What is the fruit of God's Holy Spirit? This is what should be manifest in our lives if we're the children of God. The fruit of the Spirit is love. That's the very first thing mentioned, love. We read the definition in 1 Corinthians 13, didn't we? Joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness. How gentle can you be when you're really angry and upset about something? Not very gentle. You know, in a time like that, you know what the best thing a person could do? Just walk away from it until you cool down. If it takes 2 or 3 hours or 2 or 3 days to cool down, then don't say anything until one is cooled down. That's the ideal thing to do. Goodness, faith, meekness. Here again, we read this word meekness. Temperance, against such there is no law. And they that are Christ have crucified the flesh with the affections and lusts. Now just remember, God has laid upon the church membership a responsibility. And that responsibility should continue forthwith. But how that responsibility is handled is paramount, and whether it's going to be successful, but most important of all, whether it really follows God's instruction. Because if it follows God's instruction, it will be successful. So, to ask the four basic questions once again, how do we handle these problems? First, we must take the beam out of our own eye. Secondly, we should do unto others as we would like to have done to us. However, remember, if there really is a problem, there is a necessity to be firm and to see that the problem is resolved and not to back down, but by the same token, to handle it in a proper and a wise manner. Restore, if there's going to be any restoring, it should be done in a spirit of meekness. That should be the aim and goal, is to restore someone, not to see how much damage and hurt can be done. And then fourthly, the key, the real key to the whole approach is love. So I think if we can apply these principles in this particular application that we find with respect to resolving problems, it can only turn out for the good and for the best for everyone.